400 Blows was one of my favorite movies.
She wore a black knit sweater vest over a dark blue shirt. The sweater had a red and white argyle pattern stitched at the breast. The outfit looked really good on her. I tried to come up with a smooth compliment, but couldn't find one. Unable to think of anything better, I said, "That outfit suits you, too." She furrowed her brows again.
"What? Too formal?"
She walked off several strides ahead of me. I might have soured her mood. I shut my mouth and chased after her. There was something I desperately wanted to know. I didn't even know her name yet. Just as I quickened my pace, she stopped. I stopped alongside her. She was looking off to the side. I turned to where she was looking and saw a gated entrance to an elementary school. The girl was contemplating the heavy iron gate that stood about 5 feet tall. The school ground stretched beyond it, shrouded in darkness. A fearless smile appeared on her face. Knowing exactly what she was thinking, I said to her, "Maybe we shouldn't." Three vertical lines creased her forehead. Paying me no mind, the girl marched up to the gate, grabbed hold of the top with both hands, reared back, and jumped. She swung one foot on top of the crossbar and inched it over to the other side until she was sitting on top of the gate. All she had to do was swing the other leg over to the other side, and she was trespassing on school property. Straddling the top of the gate as if it were a horse, the girl looked over at me proudly. I had to look down. Her skirt was bunched up to her waist, exposing her bare legs. But she didn't seem the least bit concerned about it. I heard a thud, and when I looked up, she was on the other side of the gate, her round eyes seeming to say, "Your turn." I went up to the gate, put both hands on the crossbar, and jumped over it in one motion. At first, she seemed disappointed at being shown up, but that expression soon faded. "Nice move," she said, and smiled. We strolled around the schoolyard three times.
"Did you like school lunches back in elementary school?" the girl asked.
"My school didn't have school lunches."
"That's weird. Did you go to private school?"
"Yeah."
"Me? I hated school lunches. Everyone in school eating the same thing at the same time. Don't you think that's kind of creepy?"
"I know what you mean."
"I was watching Escape from Alcatraz the other day. And there was a scene where the inmates all have to eat the same thing at the same time that reminded me of school lunches. Do you like Clint Eastwood?"
"Sure. Pale Rider is my favorite."
"My favorite has to be Dirty Harry."
The two of us grabbed hold of the horizontal bars in the playground and swayed back and forth like a pair of baby monkeys.
"What kind of music do you listen to?"
she asked. "All different kinds. But I guess I don't listen to a lot of Japanese music."
"Why not?"
"I don't know. I never really thought about it." "What kind of music do you listen to?"
"I listen to all different kinds. But I guess I don't listen to a lot of Japanese music."
"Why not?"
"I don't know. I never really thought about it."
"I guess that makes us the same."
"I guess it does."
We strolled over to a bronze bust of some famous person in the corner of the schoolyard and took turns poking our fingers up his nose.
"Any dreams for the future?" she asked.
I thought about it and answered, "If I could, I'd go to a top-tier college, get in with an elite corporation, fly up the promotional ladder, and if I could, marry a pretty girl, have two adorable kids, build a house in the city, retire, and then learn to play Go. If I could, I'd take my wife's hand in mine on a warm autumn day and tell her how happy I was to have spent my life with her and pass away quietly of old age."
"Are you serious? Would you really want to live a life like that if you could?"
"Yeah." I noticed her look down. "Why are you laughing? Did I say something funny?"
"You should hear how the boys I know talk. They all say, 'I'm going to be famous.' They can never tell you in any concrete terms how they're going to get famous, but they're all ready to tell you, 'I'm going to be huge someday.'"
"That's because they're trying to get your attention," They're trying to tell you they're a sure thing.
Don't you want to get my attention?
I floundered for an answer.
So why don't you think you'd be able to have a life like you imagined? You could if you really tried, right?
When I didn't answer, she asked,
What's wrong? Did I ask something I shouldn't have?
I'm going to be like Bill Gates someday.
You can't impress me that way now,
she strode off ahead of me. When I caught up to her, we lay down and sprawled out in the middle of the schoolyard.
It's so peaceful, she said.
Yeah. We gazed at the stars for a while. Would you mind telling me your name? I asked.
We don't need to bother with names, do we?
She said. I looked over in her direction. She relented and said,
Sakurai.
What's your first name?
I don't want to say. I hate my first name.
I'm
Sugihara.
How did you...
I read your mind earlier, said Sakurai, smiling. But I couldn't read the first name. What is it?
We don't need to bother with names.
I know, right?
Yeah. A shooting star streaked down above us. Its red tail was clearly visible, even in the well-lit sky of Tokyo. Sakurai shot up in a sitting position.
Did you see that?
I sat up, turned to her, and nodded.
This is horrible. I've never been so embarrassed in front of a boy in my life.
Embarrassed?
A shooting star? There's absolutely nothing more embarrassing than gazing up at the sky with a boy and seeing a shooting star, don't you think?
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. God, you didn't make a wish or anything like that, did you?
I shook my head. I didn't have time.
Oh, good.
The lines on her forehead disappeared, and a really sweet smile came across her face.
Please don't tell anyone about the shooting star. It's just too embarrassing. It'll be just our secret.
What would other guys do in this situation? I wanted to touch her. Anywhere would have been fine. If I could reach out and she didn't spurn my touch, I knew that I could make this restless feeling that was consuming me go away. I don't want to lose this girl smiling in front of me. I felt something strong for this girl I barely knew, and I believed that maybe she would let me touch her. While I went back and forth about whether to reach out my hand, she jumped to her feet.
We should be getting back.
Feeling both relieved and heartbroken, I nodded and stood up. When we got to the gate, she said,
You go first. I want to see you jump from behind.
I jumped over the gate in one motion. I waited for her on the other side. She beckoned me back. Assuming she needed help getting over, I reached across the gate with both arms, when suddenly she grabbed hold and drew me in, my body pressed up against the gate. Sakurai's face came closer to mine.
I knew you were a great jumper, she said,
and pressed her lips against mine.
What soft lips.
Whatever it was that Sakurai knew about me, I didn't give a damn. At that moment, I couldn't care less. We stood there with the gate between us and kissed for a while. That restless feeling from earlier had completely vanished. 3. That night, Sakurai and I ended up walking to Tamachi Station. I bought a newspaper and pen from a kiosk, and we each tore off a piece of the newspaper and wrote down our phone numbers.
What are you doing next Sunday? Sakurai asked.
I'm seeing a friend. Sakurai's forehead wrinkled.
Are you going out with another girl?
I hastily shook my head. I'm just seeing a guy. She stared into my eyes hard.
I don't like lies, okay?
After a short silence, I nodded. Although there were lots of things I hadn't told her yet, I hadn't lied. We passed through the ticket barrier, and before we went to our respective platforms, Sakurai asked mischievously,
What would you do if I said I really wanted to see you Sunday?
I'd go see my friend. He's someone I need to keep my promises to.
Sounds like he's a really good friend.
He is.
Now let me tell you about when I was going to Korean school. Like I said, I received my elementary and junior high school education at North Korean school. I learned Korean, North Korean history, and all about the great leader Kim Il-sung. I also learned the kind of stuff they teach in Japanese school, like Japanese, math, and physics. The great leader Kim Il-sung. If you're going to talk about Korean schools, there's definitely no avoiding this guy. Ever since I was a kid, I've been given an earful about just how great and honorable he was. A communist society like North Korea doesn't recognize religion, but needs something resembling one to unify its people. Kim Il-sung was that something, the charismatic founder of a religion. As much as I can explain it now, I definitely couldn't understand it back then, so despite thinking how weird it was to be forced to swear blind loyalty to Kim, I simply accepted it as normal. I had spent my entire childhood in a North Korean school, which, after all, was really an organized religion. Then one day in the third grade, I came to a realization. It happened during a lecture titled, Kim's Early Years. The focus of the lecture that day was about how young Kim Il-sung used a slingshot he'd made to attack a Japanese official who'd come to his home to arrest his father for inciting the anti-Japanese movement. The moral of the story was how great Kim Il-sung was, even as a child. But what I thought was this. We're greater than this guy. I was thinking about how the year before, when I was in second grade, I was walking home from school with some friends and a police car came up behind us. Seeing some of us spilling over into the road, the female officer yelled into the megaphone mounted on the police car, "Walk on the side of the road, you pieces of human garbage!" None of us were particularly hurt by this. There were always right-wing propaganda trucks coming around the school hurling much worse insults, so we were used to the abuse. We were used to it, sure. But it still pissed us off. So the next day, we quickly got together a bicycle squad and began a series of guerrilla-style attacks on the police. Our mission was simple. Patrol the neighborhood on our bicycles, our baskets loaded with water balloons, and when we found a cop car, bomb them and run. We succeeded in pulling off one attack after another. We carefully planned our escape route down side streets beforehand. Not once were we caught. About 2 weeks into our campaign, a water balloon landed on the windshield of a police car and broke. The kid who threw it had filled the balloon with water mixed with black, green, red, and brown paint. Deprived of a clear view for an instant, the car drifted across the road like a Formula One race car and crashed into the guardrail. After safely escaping the scene, we climbed up onto the roof of an apartment building and watched the aftermath of the accident. One of the two female officers involved in the crash was in tears. We didn't want to be bullies, so we decided to forgive and forget and put an end to our attacks. By the way, we were never told what happened to Kim Il-sung after he attacked the official with the slingshot. Did he get away with it? All kidding aside, if Kim Il-sung could walk on water like that other charismatic religious leader guy, I could see myself being so taken with that incredibly tall tale that I might pledge my loyalty to him. But to me, all the stories about the legendary Kim Il-sung were lacking. There was nothing appealing about them, or exciting. And that's how I came to this realization that day in third grade. Our stories are better. After that, my teachers started calling me the biggest dumbass since the school's founding. I quit studying, my grades went down the toilet, and I started making up all kinds of ridiculous excuses to stay home from school. I hated school with a passion, especially what took place at the end of the school day. General review and self-criticism, the communists' favorite pastime. A typical review, or soukatsu, went something like this. The teacher would single out one student for speaking Japanese in school, make him own up to his offense, and then force him to rat out another student who was guilty of the same.
If you refuse to talk, you might get smacked. We never blamed anyone for ratting someone else out, though. After all, we were only doing it so we could be dismissed and hang out together after school. As long as this practice of general review and self-criticism continued, I had no intention of accepting communism. Practices leading up to the annual athletic festival consisted mostly of group exercises. In fourth grade, military-style foot drills were added to our practices. A perfect military march. The practices continued until our rubber-soled shoes could produce the same sound that military shoes made. And before any of us knew it, we had become youth members of the Kim-led Korean Workers' Party, and were told we'd fight for Kim Il-sung one day. I wanted nothing to do with it. At school, there was this feeling of being repressed, of being kept under constant and strict control. So around the start of the fourth grade, I began to make up excuses like, the left side of my head hurts, or the backs of my eyes feel hot, or I have a splitting tongue ache, and stayed home from school. While my father, who was still an enthusiastic member of Chongryom back then, wasn't exactly thrilled with me ditching school, he didn't force me to go either. And since my mother was happy to have me around the house, I skipped school with my parents' approval. One day, soon after I started fifth grade, my father, who'd seen me watching movies all day, asked, "Isn't there something you'd rather be doing?" After some thought, I said that I wanted him to teach me to box. I had just watched Rocky the other day. The pachinko business allowed my father to keep pretty flexible hours, so my training began the very next day. The first day, we headed for the big neighborhood park, the one with the running trails. Once we arrived, my father walked straight into the grassy area in the middle of the park. I followed him. When we got to the middle, my father and I faced each other, standing some distance apart. He stared at me for a while, saying nothing. Just what kind of training did he have in store for me? I was a little nervous. Then he finally opened his mouth. "Hold out your left arm," he said. I did as I was told. "Now turn around once." "Huh?" "Just turn around once in either direction, like a compass." The look on his face was dead serious. I turned around counterclockwise with my arm extended in front of me. When I came around so that I was looking at my old man again, he said, "The circle you made with your fist is roughly the size you are. If you stay inside that circle and take only the things within your reach, you can go through life without ever getting hurt. Do you understand what I'm saying?" I nodded slowly. "What do you think about that?" "I think that's lame," I answered, without skipping a beat. The old man cracked a smile. "Boxing is the act of breaking through the circle with your own fists and taking something from outside it. Outside is crawling with tough guys, and while you're trying to get something, someone else might come inside and take something of yours. It hurts to hit, and hurts to get hit. Fighting is a scary thing. Now, do you still want to learn to box? You know you're safer staying inside that circle." I answered without the slightest hesitation, "Yes." My father cracked another smile. "Then let's get started." At first, he forced me to run, and then run some more. "The boxing happens above the torso, sure, but a strong punch is generated from strong footwork. A house built on a bad foundation will easily collapse. That's why you run." After I was able to run the trails without losing my breath, he taught me how to throw a punch. In the beginning, I had a habit of lifting the heel of my pivot foot when I punched. "Plant your foot. Don't make an enemy of the ground." Next came footwork. During his fighting days, my father was your typical swarmer. He stood and traded blows with his opponent. So naturally, I expected him to teach me infighting techniques. I was wrong. My old man began to move right and left, backward and forward with easy, flowing steps. As I watched in wonder, he stopped and cracked an invincible grin. "Outboxers don't play well to the crowd. I needed the money.
Sometimes you have to lose something to get something back. At first, I kept my knees straight and stiff, so my footwork was leaden.
Bend your knees a little and keep them moving. Keep your knees loose, and they can absorb the force of a punch. A tree that is unbending is easily broken in a powerful storm, but not grass.
Scratching the scar at the corner of one eye, he added,
"Or so says some guy named Lao Tzu."
His conscience must have nagged him for plagiarizing the Chinese philosopher. On non-training days, such as when it was too rainy or when my father had to work, I went with my mother to Ginza and watched a movie. My mother loved watching Hollywood movies on the big screen. Afterward, she'd always look at me with her eyes twinkling and say, "Wasn't that good?" I always smiled and nodded, no matter how boring the movie. After the movie, we usually went to Senbikiya or Shiseido Parlor and got something sweet to eat. Although I wasn't exactly a fan of sweets, my mother would look at me with a cherubic smile and say, "Isn't it good?" And I'd smile and nod. Sometimes I'd think I didn't need school as long as I had my mother and father in my life. Unfortunately, this honeymoon with my parents didn't last. In the middle of the sixth grade, I abruptly hit a rebellious phase. My last day of training with my father was July 7th, the day of the Star Festival. I dragged my feet all the way to the park. My father and I entered the grassy area and stood facing each other.
"Today, I'll teach you how to duck into a right-left combination," he smiled. "Ready, Luke?"
The night before, my father had come into the living room where I was watching Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, on video, and began to watch along with me, something he almost never did. While he watched the training scenes with Luke Skywalker and Master Yoda, he kept nodding with this look of satisfaction. I had a bad feeling. When the movie ended, my father said,
"Luke, you may call me Yoda."
"You're Darth Vader, any way I look at you."
And so, there was already an ominous air on this last day of training. And then, just as I was about to totally lose it for being called Luke a third time, thick blue clouds began to cover the sky. Thunder rumbled in the distance. Looking up, my father said,
"Doesn't look good. Let's get out of here."
Too late. The heavy rain came down upon us as we reached the park exit. My father and I ran back into the park and took cover beneath a great ginkgo tree that looked about 300 years old. We squatted near the foot of the tree and stared idly at the rain coming down in thick strands. Then my father said in a voice barely audible above the rain hitting the ground,
"What do you want to be in the future?"
After a long pause, I answered, "Castro." The old man gave me a look as if to say, "Smart aleck," and turned his gaze back on the rain. His eye slowly traced the thick strands upward until he was looking up at the sky.
"Seems connected all the way up to heaven," he said in a small voice. "I wonder if heaven really is a good place."
All I could think then was that he must have been knocked in the head one too many times, but in retrospect, I think I understand what he might have been feeling. My father had suffered the loss of one of his exchange booths only a short while before. The old man dropped his head and inhaled deeply. Then he looked at me and grinned.
"Well, my mind's made up," he said. "I'm going to make like a carp climbing up a waterfall and climb right up to heaven. You can come with me if you want."
He ran out from under the tree, into the hard rain, into the grassy area, and began jumping up and down, jumping toward the heavens. Again and again, beaming from ear to ear. At times, he went into some odd dance steps. Every move was like nothing I'd seen before. Anyway, seeing as how I was in this rebellious phase, all I could think was, "What is this punch-drunk old man doing?" But his moves might have looked a little like Gene Kelly's dance from Singing in the Rain. That scene never fails to lift my spirits, no matter how many times I watch it. Soon the thick clouds moved on and the rain stopped.
The sun appeared and bathed the grass in its warmth. Standing on the grass carpet, my father looked at me with his head crooked a little to the side, as if he were asking a question, "Why didn't you come with me?" After I entered junior high school, I started to go to school regularly again. I still hated school with a passion. I only went because my friends were there. They were all like blood brothers to me. We expected to go through school with more or less the same students up until high school. It was like going through a long, extended training camp together, which created a bond beyond friendship. And what caused this bond to truly blossom was a nutrient called, you guessed it, prejudice. This is going to sound like a joke, I know, but every year on April 29, on Emperor Showa's birthday, Japanese students from sports clubs and conservative student groups all over came to our school on a so-called Korean hunt, so we had to walk home in groups. We had to stick together whether we wanted to or not. Spending every waking minute with this bunch was incredibly comfortable, not to mention a blast. Though we never said it out loud, none of us believed that we would amount to much, so we might as well live it up while we were in the cradle of school. Although I've never been to Carnival, I understand why the working people of Rio cut loose during Carnival season. In the swirl of Carnival, they were the center of attention. The others couldn't even dance the steps. My friends and I invented all sorts of games, roughhoused until we hurt and laughed until we couldn't breathe. "Stop laughing like a bunch of idiots," our teachers told us. "Show some awareness and self-respect as North Koreans." Sure, I hated school, but surrounded by my group of friends, I had a sense of security. I felt that I was protected by something. Even if that something drew a tight, complete circle around me and choked me to the point of suffocation, leaving that circle required a fair amount of courage. My parents' trip to Hawaii and Tawake's disappearance turned out to give me the courage I needed. So now I'll tell you about Tawake's disappearance. Tawake was a senpai, an upperclassman, 2 years my senior, who ran the 100-meter dash in 11.2 seconds as a third year in junior high school. He had short, bristly hair that was unbending in the wind, even when he ran at top speed. There was a rumor that he'd headbutted someone in a fight and made tiny holes all over the guy's skin. His hair was as coarse as a scouring brush. Tawashi, scouring brush, plus ke, hair, abbreviated became Tawake. I called him Tawake, and in turn he called me crazy and looked after me like a brother. Right after entering junior high school, a bunch of us first years were rounded up on Tawake's orders and roped into fighting a motorcycle gang. There was a strict hierarchy in Korean schools, owing to the influence of Confucianism, and a senpai's orders were absolute. We glared at each other from a distance. Tawake ordered me, "Go!" Out of my mind with nerves, I answered, "Okay," and took off alone toward the mob. I got the stuffing beat out of me and sustained injuries that took 2 weeks to recover from. "Who actually does that?" said Tawake in disbelief. "You're crazy, you know that?" With that, the nickname Crazy stuck throughout my junior high school years. Tawake was the star striker on the soccer team and something of a legend in our school. I was on the basketball team, but as soon as practice ended, I spent most days prowling the streets with Tawake. We'd go looking for someone to scrap with and fight them. No reason necessary. If we locked eyes and the other guy didn't look away, game on. Tawake and I were always angry. We didn't know why. All we knew was that basketball and soccer alone weren't going to relieve our anger. Whenever a battle royale broke out against a mob of kids from another school, the police would arrive on the scene and try to chase us down. I always ran in the same direction Tawake did, but it wasn't long before I'd lose sight of his bristly, unbending hair. I could never catch up to him. The police had never been able to catch Tawake. On the day of Tawake's graduation, I handed him a bouquet of flowers. He smiled bashfully and gave my thighs a gentle kick.
Keep working those legs. We're nothing if we can't run fast.
The last time I saw Tawake was during spring recess of my second year in junior high, a little while before my father confronted me about choosing my country of citizenship. Tawake called me out of the blue, and the two of us went to an izakaya and drank. Tawake, who'd gone on to North Korean high school, had grown bigger since I'd seen him last, and was now able to run the 100-meter dash in 10.9 seconds. We caught each other up on the latest news, and when I told him about my father's recent Hawaiian awakening, Tawake laughed his head off. Once he stopped, he asked,
"Have you thought about what you're going to do in the future?"
I shook my head.
"Are you thinking about going to Korean high school, graduating and working at a Korean-owned pachinko parlor or a yakiniku restaurant, or as a money lender like me? Or are you going to be a doctor or lawyer?"
We looked at each other and laughed. In Zainichi society, this was the fairy tale that parents told their children. Even North Koreans can take the Japanese national examination and become doctors and lawyers. But the reality was, none of us ever dreamed of being a doctor or lawyer or anything that required a national examination. Lou Reed had our situation exactly right in Dirty Boulevard. People like us don't get to dream. Maybe Lou Reed was Zainichi. Anyway, none of the people around me wanted to become doctors or lawyers or believed they could ever become one. We weren't raised in a system that made that sort of thing possible. That fairy tale every North Korean parent told their kid sounded like this to my ears. Join a Serie A league soccer club and score a goal. Tawake. Now he might have been able to score a goal. Although there's not much point in talking hypothetically, if Tawake had been Japanese, he would easily have become a great player in the J-League, been scouted by a foreign club, and gotten rich and famous playing in Serie A or the Bundesliga. Tawake was born in Japan, was raised in Japan, and spoke Japanese. He also happened to be a foreigner with North Korean citizenship. It was virtually impossible for a foreigner to reach the J-League, much less become rich and famous. Tawake had run into an obstacle that had finally stopped him in his tracks. This was the story Tawake told me around the time three empty beer bottles sat on the table.
"I got fingerprinted a while back."
Back then, the government still had a fingerprinting system for foreign residents. When you turned 16, you had to go to the Alien Registration Office and get your fingerprints taken, like a criminal. I'd already been fingerprinted on one of my trips down to the station, but for Tawake, who had never been caught, it was a first. I was going to go down to the registration office and punch the daylights out of the bastards. You can get into trouble for refusing to get fingerprinted. I didn't want the hassle, so I figured I'd get at least a little payback by decking the bastards at the office. Tawake lifted his beer glass to his lips and drained it.
But when I got there, this old man with a gimpy leg came out. He acted so sorry and kept saying, "Thank you for coming down," to me, a kid. He must have said it about 15 times. And then a girl with this big birthmark on her face brought the fingerprint form and didn't look at me once, but shielded my hands with her notebook the whole time so the others couldn't see I was getting fingerprinted. I forgot about punching anybody after that. I must have said sorry about 10 times. More times than I've ever said it in all my life.
Tawake looked at me with a serious expression and continued.
They finally got me. The government's power is a terrifying thing. You have to be pretty fast to outrun it.
Walking back from the izakaya, Tawake drunkenly smacked my head and kept muttering,
"Hawaii. Crazy. Hawaii."
He gave me a wobbly kick in the thighs and said,
"I'll see ya."
I bowed and began walking away. From behind me, I heard the first word Tawaka had ever said to me. Go! When I turned around, Tawaka had turned around and was already walking in the opposite direction. His hair stood tall and unbending against the wind. That was the last time I saw him. The story I heard later was that Tawaka had switched from North Korean to South Korean citizenship and quit high school before that last night I saw him. Then he was gone. No one knew where he went. According to rumors, he had gone to France and joined a foreign mercenary unit, or to England and became a hooligan leader, or to Amsterdam, where he became king of the hippies. Wherever he was, I was sure he was running. Running so fast that no one could catch him. As soon as I started my third year in junior high, I announced to my teachers that I was going to take the Japanese high school entrance exams. I expected them to laugh me out of the room, the school's biggest dumbass shooting his mouth off again, but the school had fallen on hard times. The number of students going to North Korean schools was declining every year, and if this continued, the survival of the school was at risk, so they hated to lose even a single student. But that wasn't what the vice principal called me in to tell me.
We don't mind if you go to a Japanese school, but what we can't have is the other students hearing about it and getting ideas of their own. So taking the Japanese entrance exams has to remain a secret.
And that was how I was given my discharge notice. The vice principal also said this,
"What makes you think you can get into a Japanese high school in the first place? When you come crying back to us, we won't admit you to the high school. Keep that in mind as you study for the exams."
I wasn't particularly hurt by this. Back then, I couldn't even read the English word certainly, pronounced George as geroge, and thought the past tense of leave was leaved. So, no, I wasn't particularly hurt by what the vice principal said, but it did piss me off. I began to study like crazy. I quit the basketball team, saying that my joints were screwed up. Quit looking for trouble after school, citing a moral awakening. Secretly went to a cram school and studied like never before. A certain friend spotted me going into the cram school one afternoon, and the next morning it was all over school. Then the bullying by the teachers began. One day, about a month before my high school entrance exams, I was so tired from studying the night before that I fell asleep in the History of Kim Il-sung's Revolution class. I was slapped awake by the teacher's hard palm. The class was stopped mid-lecture. And after I was made to sit on my heels before the teacher's desk, the teacher ordered me to criticize my behavior. I kept quiet since I couldn't think of anything to criticize, and the teacher struck me again. A metallic ringing filled my ear. It was a familiar sound. My eardrum had burst. I took 3 toe kicks in the thigh. It hurt so bad that tears welled up in my eyes. I took 5 finger flicks to the bridge of my nose. It hurt so bad that 5 happy memories flew out of my brain. I was grabbed by the ear and pulled down to the ground. I bit down on my humiliation so hard that blood seeped from my gums. I was called an ethnic traitor and kicked in the pit of the stomach, then called a sellout and struck across the face again. I couldn't really understand what that last one meant. I knew the literal meaning of the word, of course, but I just couldn't bring myself to think that I was a sellout. I could sense the incongruity of the label, but didn't have the words to express it. Then someone who was able to say exactly what I was feeling appeared, like a superhero. A voice rose up from the back of the classroom. "We've never belonged to a country we could sell out." Sunday. I arrived at the east exit of Shinjuku Station 5 minutes before the appointed time and found Jong-il leaning against the pillar by the ticket barrier, reading a paperback. I snuck up on him and, without making a sound, peered over at the book. It was I Am a Cat by Soseki Natsume.
"Any good?"
Jong-il closed the book. "Is the spirit of Japan triangular? Is it, do you think, a square? As the words themselves explicitly declare, it's an airy, fairy, spiritual thing, he said, reciting a passage from the novel.
Sounds interesting.
He continued his recitation. There's not one man in the whole of Japan who has not used the phrase, but I have not met one user yet who knows what it conveys. The spirit of Japan, the Japanese spirit, could it conceivably be nothing but another of those long-nosed goblins only the mad can see?
Jong-il smiled at me good-naturedly. I adored Jong-il's smile.
Jong-il was born to a Zainichi father and a Japanese mother. His father left when Jong-il was 3 and had been MIA ever since. When it came time for Jong-il to start elementary school, his mother put him straight into North Korean school. Since North Korean schools were classified as miscellaneous schools and thus didn't qualify for subsidies, tuition was expensive, but she worked tirelessly to pay it. Thus, a strange half-Korean, half-Japanese student with South Korean citizenship was born. By the start of 5th grade, Jong-il was called the brightest student since the school's founding. And because, in part, we were never in the same class until we entered junior high school, I, the biggest dumbass since the school's founding, hardly ever talked to him. We've never belonged to a country we could sell out. By the time Jong-il made that declaration, he had achieved perfect grades and attendance for 8 years running, could correctly pronounce certainly in English, explain the present perfect tense, and read and write cursive letters. Not to mention he'd never shoplifted, shaken anyone down for money, or gotten in a fistfight. He avoided groups altogether. Jong-il was always alone. Even the teachers didn't know how to relate to him. None of my other friends tried to get to know him either. Jong-il's rebellious declaration on my behalf got him hit by the teacher for the first time. After racking my brain, I bought a PlayStation with what little money I had and gave it to Jong-il as a thank you gift. At first, he looked at the console as if he didn't know what to do with it, but smiled good-naturedly and said thanks. A teacher found the PlayStation and ended up confiscating it. We both got smacked for that. It was a mistake to give it to Jong-il at school. Jong-il and I became friends anyway. After I was miraculously admitted to a Japanese high school and started going there, I grew further apart from the friends I used to hang out with. The environments that we lived in had completely changed, of course, and in the end, I had become an outsider to my friends. Jong-il had continued into North Korean high school, but we kept in touch. In fact, our friendship grew deeper. We met at least once a month and talked about a whole lot of things. Well, actually, we talked a whole lot about the usual topics. Jong-il and I went into a cafe and killed time until dinner. As soon as we settled into our seats, I pulled out a copy of Stephen Jay Gould's The Mismeasure of Man from my backpack and handed it to him. My number one pick this month. What is it about? Jong-il asked. Don't believe scientists pushing the theory of genetic determinism. I don't follow. Let's say, for example, you and I both have small skulls. Some diabolical scientist lumps us all together and comes out and says all Koreans have small skulls and therefore are stupid. That data could be used to oppress us, which is what happened to blacks and Indians in America. Jong-il said, I'll give it a try. He slipped the book into his bag and then took out another paperback and gave it to me. It was In Exile by Takeshi Kaiko.
It's really cool, said Jong-il.
Riffling through the pages of the book, I said, you're always reading novels. I didn't believe in the power of the novel. A novel could entertain, but couldn't change anything. You open the book, you close it, and it's over. Nothing more than a tool to relieve stress. Every time I said as much, Jong-il would say something cryptic like, A lone person devoted to reading novels has the power equal to 100 people gathered at a meeting. Then he'd continue saying, "The world would be a better place with more people like that," and smile good-naturedly. And then it felt like maybe he was right. After putting the book in my backpack, I said, "The book you lent me last time, Akutagawa's Aphorisms by a Pygmy, it was cool." A joyful smile spread across Jung-il's face. When we finished catching each other up on the latest news, the conversation shifted to university. Although I intended to take the entrance exams, I felt conflicted about it. University was essentially a breeding ground for salarymen, and I had no use for such a place. The reason was simple. Even if I did become a salaryman, my nationality prevented me from becoming company president. Deprived of my greatest ambition from the start, I had no intention of slaving away in the system. "If you're not going to university, what are you going to do?" Jung-il asked. "Haven't thought about it. Definitely not work 9 to 5. "Then maybe you can take the 4 years at university to decide." "Sounds like 4 random years. Jung-il took a sip from his lukewarm coffee and said in a serious tone, "But you should live a random life. I mean, your life has already veered off the rails. I wish you'd keep on veering and see where it takes you. You're someone who could pull that off. But, you know, that's just me." Jung-il smiled good-naturedly. I fidgeted in embarrassment. I'd almost never had the experience of being praised by a teacher. Now I knew the feeling. After getting into a Japanese university, Jung-il planned to get his teaching license and become a teacher for a North Korean school. "Then why don't you live a random life with me?" I asked. Jung-il shook his head. "I'm not the type." "How could you know that now?" "Because I do. Those things are already decided from the start." "You sound like a diabolical scientist." "No, this is different. What I'm talking about is something like a person's role in life." "Forget about roles. If I did that, I'd stop being me." I let out a short sigh. "Please don't tell me you're going back to that small circle." Jung-il drank the cold coffee and said gently, "Do you remember when you said North Korean school was like an organized religion?" I nodded. Jung-il continued, "I don't know all that much about religion, but if it serves the role of taking in vulnerable people of all kinds, then we definitely need Korean schools." "Except that I was already in it before I had a choice. Vulnerable had nothing to do with it." "Me too. But if I'd gone to a Japanese school, I might have been bullied and killed myself."
"No way."
"It's true. I used to get bullied all the time by the boys in my neighborhood. They said all sorts of horrible things, too. If they tried to televise it, all you'd hear is one long bleep." There was a pause, and then Jung-il and I laughed. Jung-il stopped giggling and said, "But when I started going to the North Korean school, I saw tough guys like you jumping around, and then I was just tougher. I didn't care what the bullies in the neighborhood said to me." Another silence passed between us. Then I said, "It's too bad we weren't friends back then. I would have beat down every one of them." Jung-il narrowed his eyes at me as if he were looking at something bright and said, "You know what? You did." We looked at each other and let out a sheepish laugh. "It's for kids like me that we need organized religion," Jung-il continued matter-of-factly. "I'm going to study hard at a Japanese university and come back with the proper knowledge the kids coming up after us will need to break out into the wider world. I want to give them the courage that you guys gave me. I'm going to tell them about you too. About the ridiculously tough-as-nails senpai that went to their school. You better not disappoint them." The usual good-natured smile was spread across Jung-il's face. I fidgeted in my seat again. "You're going to make a great leader." Jung-il chuckled bashfully and said, "The organization is beginning to change since Kim Il-sung died. They're slowly turning an eye toward the outside world. Maybe North Korean schools will have evolved into something better by the time I come back." When Kim Il-sung died a short while back, I felt nothing. In my mind, I had completely closed the book on Kim, never to be opened again. I caught a glimpse of the clock on the wall. It was past 7. I grabbed the check and said, "Let's get something to eat." We went to the yakiniku place on Shinjuku Gochome. The restaurant took up the 8th through 12th floors of a 12-story building, and Jung-il and I went up to the entrance on the 8th floor. It was dinner time on a Sunday night, so the restaurant was packed. As we were jostled by the crowd of customers waiting for tables to open up, the hostess, an elegantly made-up woman wearing a chic black dress with her hair tied back, appeared.
"Reservation for 2?"
Although we hadn't made reservations, I answered the woman's question with a nod. She led us to the elevator and got on with us. As soon as the door closed, I said, "You look like the mistress of some Chinese mafia boss." My mother smacked me on the side of the head. Jung-il chuckled.
"Nice to see you again, Jung-il," my mother said.
Jung-il gave her a proper bow and said, "You're looking as pretty as ever." With a pleased smile, my mother said,
"I have some delicious meat set aside for you, Jung-il."
The elevator opened on the 12th floor. As we stepped off, I gave Jung-il a kick in the stomach. Pervy bastard. My mother led us into a private room in the back with tatami floors and left. The night view from the windows was beautiful. Naomi-san appeared with cups of tea and warm hand towels, just as I had rolled over on my side on the tatami mat and groaned, "Damn, I'm hungry." She was wearing a really elegant navy kimono. I sprang upright and sat on my heels.
"Welcome. Nice to see you again."
The outer corners of her eyes turned slightly downward as she smiled flirtatiously. I nearly melted. I glanced at Jung-il. His eyes were sagging dreamily at the corners, too. Pervy bastard. Setting the tea and towels neatly in front of Jung-il and me, she asked,
"So, how are my rising Zainichi stars? Studying hard?"
Jung-il and I simultaneously answered yes and nodded deeply. Another heart-melting smile appeared on her face. Naomi-san and my mother were school friends. In high school, she had been known for her good looks. After graduating, she was chosen to be Miss Ice Cream, Miss Grape, and Miss Goldfish, and she went on to become a fashion model. Since both South Korean and North Korean citizenship got in the way of traveling overseas, she became a naturalized Japanese citizen. She quit modeling before she turned 31.
"It's a long story," she explained once when I asked her why she had quit.
She looked kind of sexy when she said it. She ended up taking over her father's business, managing the yakiniku restaurant. By the way, Naomi wasn't an alias or a stage name, but her given name. She used to be bullied in North Korean school for having a Japanese name. My mother stepped in and defended her, and they became good friends.
"I hope you're hungry," Naomi-san said.
Jung-il and I nodded.
"I'll bring your food right out. Just give me a minute."
Naomi-san left the room. With his eyes still sagging downward at the corners, Jung-il, as if in a dream, said,
"You know she's single, right?"
I grabbed one of his legs and put him in an ankle lock to awake him. Pervy bastard. By the end of dinner, Jung-il and I were blissfully stuffed. Naomi-san came back with some lime sherbet for dessert, and she sat down and made herself comfortable. In the most adorable way, she asked me,
"Will you tell that story again?"
It was a story I'd told many times before, but I just couldn't say no to her. In the fall after I started high school, my family went to South Korea. The purpose of the trip was to visit my grandparents' grave on Jeju Island. For my father, it was a homecoming 50 years in the making. For my mother and me, it was the first time setting foot on South Korean soil. I went to the grave of my grandparents, who died before I'd ever met them, and laid down some flowers. To be honest, I didn't really feel a whole lot of anything, looking at the grave. It was nothing more than a burial mound. The incident occurred after we arrived on the mainland. We had dinner at a yakiniku place in Seoul, and afterward we got in a taxi. Actually, I got in a taxi by myself. My parents shared a taxi with a middle-aged Japanese couple they got to know at the restaurant. The couple was staying in the same hotel as we were. On the ride back to the hotel, the 40-ish driver spoke to me. "Are you Zainichi?" When I answered in Korean that I was, he snorted and curled his lips into a sneer. Many Koreans believe that Zainichi live in Japan in blessed, hardship-free comfort, and some of them zealously take swipes at Zainichi. The taxi driver appeared to